Now, shall we begin?
The last 26 years of Michael Whiteley's life is like the stuff of film noir. He is 69 years old now, and a quarter century of his life has been wasted in prison, where, barring some all but miraculous judicial intervention, he will most likely die. He is in very poor health, but he is indomitable in his determination to end his days as a free man. If he had been willing to confess to kidnapping his ex-wife, a rather turbulent Bolivian expatriate by the name of Silvia Canedo, it's quite likely that he would have served no more than 4 months in jail in 1991 and been restored to the company of his family, including his estranged first wife, Denine. The price demanded of him, however, was prohibitive. He would have been required to admit guilt for an act that he didn't commit. And so the Bonneville County Prosecutor's Office in Idaho Falls vindictively added a charge of rape. And under Idaho laws at the time, this meant that the kidnapping itself was considered as a capital offense, which meant that Whiteley could have faced the death penalty had the Bonneville County Prosecutor's Office been inclined to pursue it. I suspect that they didn't pursue the death penalty because that would have added an increment of scrutiny on the part of the judicial system that the Bonneville County Prosecutor's Office wanted to avoid. The only direct evidence of Whiteley's supposed crimes was the testimony of the supposed victim, who contradicted herself on the witness stand, both in the pretrial hearings and during the case in chief, and she recanted her accusations on several occasions, both in speech and in writing. Many key details of her story have been contradicted by multiple sworn witnesses who saw the couple in what appeared to be a rather unremarkable and indeed somewhat affectionate relationship. When Whiteley went to trial, the arresting officer, a name that should be familiar to those of you who listen to this podcast, the notorious IFPD officer Jared Furman, claimed that Canedo had disclosed the rape immediately after Whiteley's January 16, 1991 arrest for supposedly violating a civil order of protection. That civil order of protection, it turned out, had expired, which meant that the arrest itself was invalid. In spite of this supposed disclosure of a rape, Furman made no written report of that accusation at the time. He claims to have seen bruises and other injuries on Canedo that were consistent with undergoing a physical assault, and yet he made no photographic record of them. Nor was there any medical evidence that Canedo had been raped. Furman testified that when he interrogated Whiteley, he caught him in several self-contradictions, and eventually the suspect supposedly admitted to forcing himself on the unwilling victim. That supposed confession was not memorialized in any way. For his part, Whiteley has adamantly denied either kidnapping or raping Canedo. Several defense witnesses, as I mentioned earlier, who saw the couple during the trip to Utah in early 1991, during which Canedo was supposedly a victim of abduction and rape, testified that she displayed no signs of fear or anxiety and was left unattended by Whiteley as he bought gasoline and later as he arranged to rent a motel room. Rather than concealing Canedo from people who could identify him, one would assume that would be a priority if he were an actual kidnapper, particularly one who was in the business of rape as well. Whiteley made a point of introducing her to a convenience store clerk who had known him for decades. I think that the most bizarre aspect of the story is the purpose of the trip to Utah. Canedo and her mother, Raquel Gonzalez, had begged Whiteley to take his ex-wife, that is to say, his second ex-wife, to Utah in order to procure an abortion, which is a horrible thing to do. The child scheduled to be killed had not been conceived by Whiteley. According to two signed statements that were written by Canito and submitted to the court following Whiteley's conviction, during an interview earlier today, Whiteley told me that he was not aware that those letters had been written by Canito until they were provided to him many years after the fact. In these two letters, signed by Canito, she said that at the time of the trip to Utah, she was pregnant with a baby who had been conceived through rape, but the biological progenitor of that unfortunate child was an Idaho Falls police officer whose name is a matter of record but will not be disclosed at this time. Whiteley was married to Canito for a little less than a month. He had met her in late 1990 when she answered an advertisement soliciting help to clean up an apartment. Whiteley had just finished a tumultuous divorce from his first wife, Deneen, and moved to Idaho Falls from Nevada in what proved to be the forlorn hope that a change of scenery would help him overcome the emotional trauma of the breakup of his family. While he lived in Nevada, he had been employed as a bail bondsman and as a fugitive tracker. In the course of that profession, Mr. Whiteley had obtained and occasionally used handcuffs and a stun gun, and those items were found in his possession at the time of his arrest, and a rather elaborate narrative was woven in which he used these implements to restrain Sylvia Canito, and supposedly, where the stun gun was concerned, would threaten her and would injure her as a way of bringing about the abduction. Once again, there was no physical evidence adduced at the trial to support any of this. His marriage to Canito was annulled less than a month after it began, after it was discovered that she was still legally married to the father of her children, who still resided in Bolivia. By the time Whiteley went to trial, Canito had become pregnant by the IFPD officer, aborted the child, and become pregnant a second time by a man several years her junior named Keith McCabe, whom she married in March of 1991. She gave birth to that child in December of 1991. She remained married to Mr. McCabe for 16 years, then divorced him and less than a month later married a man who was 30 years older than she was, and that marriage lasted for about a year and a half. This is a woman who, with the help of her mother, was a scam artist. In 1996, Whiteley was granted a post-conviction hearing. Sylvia Canito, of course, was called to testify. If she had actually been the survivor of a kidnapping and a rape that had severely traumatized her, all that she was required to do at this point was simply to repeat her story. Rather than doing so, at the direction of her counsel, she took the Fifth Amendment 71 times when asked questions about matters for which she had previously given sworn testimony. That fact impressed itself upon the mind of District Judge Brent J. Moss of the 7th Judicial District of the state of Idaho. Mr. Whiteley's case has troubled me since I was assigned his request for post-conviction relief, wrote Judge Moss in an October 9, 2001 letter to Robert G. Hamlin, the executive director of the Judicial Council of Idaho, in response to a complaint that had been filed by Mr. Whiteley. This court considered the evidence at Mr. Whiteley's post-conviction hearing and also reviewed the entire trial transcript. That information raised some questions, but in light of the legal standards applicable to the granting of new trials, provided an insufficient basis to grant a new trial. As I've said before, the state's judicial system convicts in haste and exonerates at leisure. Findings and conclusions were thus entered and Mr. Whiteley's request for a new trial was denied, continued Judge Moss. Mr. Whiteley then filed a pro se motion seeking another evidentiary hearing, basically requesting reconsideration of the court's order dismissing his petition for post-conviction relief. The court treated that motion as one for reconsideration, reversed its previous decision, and granted Mr. Whiteley's request for a new trial. The decision to grant a new trial, explained Judge Moss, could not be supported by specific findings gleaned from the record, but rather from Ms. Canito's evasiveness in answering questions during the post-conviction hearing. Although Ms. Canito did not recant her trial testimony, I was left with the uneasy feeling that justice was not served by the original verdict, and that a new trial was appropriate. I am still of the same opinion, concluded Judge Moss in his October 9, 2001 letter. Since that time, more than 5 years have passed. Whiteley remains in prison. The judicial system of the state of Idaho remains ill-disposed toward granting him a new trial, and Sylvia Canedo has returned to Bolivia. As I said, this is a story that one would expect to encounter in a film noir, but perhaps it's the sort of thing that we should expect in Bonneville County, Idaho, and I'll have a great deal more to say about it when I return. This is Will Grigg with Freedom Zealot Radio on the Liberty News Radio Network. Please stand by for more sedition after this.
An innocent man.
Your husband's verdict has already been determined.
Can be found guilty.
His execution is scheduled for next week.
Trial counsel was grossly unprepared for trial in a case of this magnitude and apparently overwhelmed, explains Michael Whiteley's petition for post-conviction relief. In addition, the record reflects that defense counsel may have been under the impression that this case would be resolved through a plea bargain prior to trial, and when the same fell through only hours before trial, it appears the trial counsel was then unprepared to proceed to trial. Michael Whiteley complicated things by insisting on his innocence. The following witnesses were never called as defense witnesses, notwithstanding their importance to Whiteley's case and the fact that trial counsel was provided their names well in advance of trial. Peggy Orchard was interviewed by the defense and was an employee at Common Sense in Pocatello, where petitioner and Canedo stopped during the alleged kidnapping. Ms. Orchard didn't observe anything unusual between the petitioner and Canedo, which again directly contradicts Canedo's version of the events. Richard and Betty Mosley. The Mosleys are friends of the petitioner and have known him since 1967. They got to know Canedo after petitioner started his relationship with her. They could have described the close personal relationship between them during the time in question. They could have also testified to numerous lies that Canedo told them during the course of the relationship. These lies included the fact that she had recently been divorced in Bolivia when, in fact, she was committing bigamy by marrying petitioner under false pretenses. She lied to the Mosleys and claimed she was pregnant 9 days after beginning a relationship with petitioner. After Canedo caused to be issued a civil protective order and criminal charges, Canedo told the Mosleys that it had not been her idea to have these issued, but she was under pressure to have them filed by her mother and others. The others included the local leadership of the ward of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, a.k.a. the Mormon Church, that was being attended by Sylvia Canedo and her mother. She lied to the Mosleys about the reasons she left Bolivia. She lied to them about how an accident occurred on September 2nd of 1990, claiming that a deer had run out in front of the vehicle when in fact she was leaning over to give Mike a kiss as she was driving. Mitch Riplinger rented out a room in petitioner's home and was present during the time in question and observed petitioner's and Canedo's relationship. Mr. Riplinger would have testified as to the close relationship between them, which again contradicts Canedo's version of the facts and sworn testimony. I would specify at this point that the close relationship being described here involves some play-acting on Sylvia Canedo's part. She was playing a role because she wanted to obtain something from Mr. Whiteley through fraud. She was, and remains today, although she's almost 60 years old, a very attractive woman. Suzette Erickson was a friend to petitioner's son and daughter and would have been approximately 16 years old at the time of these events. She occasionally came over to petitioner's house. She observed petitioner and Canedo together during the time frame and their close relationship. She was also present when Canedo made phone calls to petitioner. This testimony again contradicts Canedo's Kenito's version, at least when she was on the witness stand, was that she was being harassed by Whiteley. Karen Vasquez, county clerk, Jack Ames, justice of the peace, and Deborah Hernandez, witness. All three were present at petitioners at Kenito's wedding in Elko, Nevada, and would have testified that they observed no pressure on Kenito to marry. One of the stories that Kenito told was that somehow Whiteley had forced her to marry him. Dispatcher Rochelle is an Idaho Falls Police Department dispatcher and received a call from Kenito and petitioner from Rupert, Idaho, regarding their trip to Elko on October 19th of 1990 to get married. She posted a note as a result of the call. That note, by the way, is found in a very large collection of documents I have obtained from the court file in the Michael Whiteley case. Kenito told Rochelle everything was okay if her mother called and reported her missing and she had gone with petitioner voluntarily. This call directly contradicts Kenito's testimony that she was forced into going to Elko and getting married, and it's of some interest to me that the police dispatcher was essentially acting as an answering service for Sylvia Kenito and her mother. Zola Nelson, Idaho Falls Police Department, came over to petitioner's house on September 24, 1990 to check on Kenito at the apparent request of Kenito's family. She talked to Kenito outside alone, told petitioner and Kenito that she had no problem with Kenito staying with petitioner since they were going to the court to get the CPO, that's the Civil Protection Order, dismissed later that day. She observed that they seemed to be getting along well, which would have contradicted Kenito's testimony. She determined that Kenito wanted to be with petitioner at that time, even though there was an outstanding protective order. Dave and Terry Orr, petitioner and Kenito, cleaned their house in November of 1990 after the November 8th CPO had been issued. They paid with a check for $35. They wanted petitioner and Kenito to return again before Thanksgiving to clean again. They could have testified that petitioner and Kenito were close and getting along well, in contradiction to Kenito's testimony. If I'm not mistaken, this is after their divorce, or the annulment, rather, of the sham marriage. Melvin Osborne of Beaver, Utah, arguably the most important witness. When petitioner and Kenito were returning from Cedar City during the alleged kidnapping, they stopped at a Standard gas station in Beaver, Utah, and ran into Melvin Osborne. Petitioner had known Mr. Osborne previously when he lived in Beaver, Utah. Mr. Osborne is a principal at the local high school where petitioner's kids attended school. Mr. Osborne could have testified that petitioner and Kenito were getting along fine and Kenito didn't appear in fear of petitioner. Kenito wandered about the gas station freely with access to other people and telephones during this alleged kidnapping. This testimony would have contradicted Kenito's version of the events. Gary and Connie Longhurst. They own a house on Lovejoy in Idaho Falls, where petitioner and Kenito were residing in September and October of 1990. They saw petitioner and Kenito together at the house on numerous occasions. They would have testified that Kenito never seemed afraid and was always very happy and close with petitioner, which contradicts Kenito's testimony. Nurses and staff at the EIRMC, where Kenito stayed from September 4th through September 11th or 12th, 1990, after her accident. The nurses and staff could have testified to the arguing between Kenito and her mother over her relationship with petitioner, which would have supported petitioner's claims at trial, namely that the mother-in-law was hostile toward him at a time when Kenito was congenial. Several nurses, including Jeff Edwards, observed petitioner and Kenito together. There are more than a dozen other witnesses on this list who were not called during the 1991 criminal trial of Michael Whiteley. I will focus on two of them. Richard Anderson of the Idaho Falls Police Department. Officer Anderson was aware of an incident where the bishop, that is to say, the leader of the Mormon congregation attended by Sylvia Kenito and her mother Raquel Gonzalez, pulled a gun on petitioner on November 8th of 1990. He also was over to petitioner's house where Kenito was present on the day of the CPO hearing. Kenito wanted petitioner to drive her to the hearing. However, Kenito ended up going with her mother, the bishop, and Paula Hegstead. Jay Whiteley. Jay Whiteley is petitioner's son. He was present when Kenito assaulted him with a knife in front of a police officer. The state refused to prosecute, supporting petitioner's claims. The police officer who witnessed this act of aggravated armed assault, according to two letters Kenito subsequently wrote and signed, is the same officer who impregnated her. According to her account, that act of intercourse was involuntary. It was essentially rape through extortion. The police officer, once again, according to Canito's account, used the leverage of threatening to prosecute her for aggravated armed assault unless she had sex with him. And that act of involuntary intercourse resulted in the conception of the baby who was killed as a result of the abortion that occurred in Utah during the trip for which Michael Whiteley was later accused of abduction and rape and threatened with the death penalty. And this was done, I contend, in order to cover up the crime committed by an Idaho Falls police officer. I will be back shortly.
After returning the verdict, they were approached by the judge in open court, and they were chastised for having reached a verdict that they reached, and they were told that they got it wrong.
And there was another comment that concerned them.
They reported to me that she made a comment to them that it was okay because she would have another chance to get this defendant because he had other charges pending.
Judge Green tells me he may take the jurors' complaints to the disciplinary council of the Supreme Court and take other action.
It is my intention, if I do nothing else, to ask the judge to recuse herself in terms of considering any other matters involving this defendant.
We've had our cameras in Judge Salerno's courtroom when she's had strong words for defendants before there was a trial or a conviction.
The attorney for an Idaho Falls man sentenced to life in prison for kidnapping and raping his ex-wife. Let's stop right there. Sentenced to life in prison. As I understand it, the sentence for kidnapping was 12 years. The sentence for rape was 25 years to life. The prosecution had originally contemplated asking for the death penalty. Sentenced to prison for life for kidnapping and raping his ex-wife, asked the Supreme Court of the state of Idaho on Friday to grant district court judges more latitude to correct what they determine may be a profound injustice. We can trust our district judges to apply this standard in a very measured and prudent fashion, attorney John Radin told the court. There is an opportunity here for the criminal justice system to uphold the bedrock foundation of a fair trial. But Deputy Attorney General Michael Henderson warned the court that such a decision would contradict previous court precedent and essentially leave the judicial system with no clear standards by which to determine when convicted felons deserve new trials. The hour-long hearing, punctuated by frequent questions from all five justices, came on the state's attempt to reverse the order of 7th District Judge Brent Moss for a new trial for Michael Whiteley, 47. This article was published, I should point out, in 1997, who has been in prison since his 1991 conviction. Under his current sentence, he will be eligible for parole in 6 more years. He was denied parole because he adamantly refuses to admit guilt. After his conviction, Whiteley began the appeal process under what is called post-conviction relief, and at the core of his petition for a new trial was the claim that new evidence had surfaced in the form of testimony from a former high school principal who saw Whiteley and his ex-wife, Sylvia Canito, during the alleged abduction at the end of their turbulent relationship, and they seemed normal. Henderson argued that the principal's testimony failed to meet the standards of new evidence because Whiteley knew about it when he was being tried 6 years ago and just failed to tell his lawyer. But during last year's hearing on his petition, Canito refused to answer the same questions about the kidnapping and rape that she answered when testifying against Whiteley during the trial. Radin also brought in other witnesses who contradicted her trial testimony. Radin contended that Canito's decision to invoke her Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination was critical new evidence that justified Moss's ultimate decision to order a new trial. And even if it fell short of qualifying as new evidence under past court rulings, he argued that it raised enough questions about the fairness of the trial and the truthfulness of Canito's original testimony that Moss should have the power to order a new trial. Bear in mind that the only witness to the alleged abduction and rape was the accuser under the ancient Deuteronomical standard of evidence. That's insufficient evidence. Henderson countered that such leeway allows a judge to ignore the rules and procedures and order a new trial just because he has a different view of the evidence and is uncomfortable with conviction. Prosecutors would be forced to put on their entire case again during post-conviction relief proceedings, he argued, just to make sure the judge is convinced the jury did the right thing the first time. The job of a jury is to force the state to prove accusations against an individual beyond a reasonable doubt. Juries need to be biased against the government. They should not be even-handed. They certainly should not be sympathetic to the state. Unfortunately, particularly in southeastern Idaho, juries tend to be composed of people who are hyper-credulous when the state makes claims against a fellow citizen. Several months after this hearing, before the Supreme Court, a former police officer from Idaho Falls who became a private investigator, which is to say he left the dark side and became a Jedi, by the name of Mel Daniel, conducted an investigation on behalf of Michael Whiteley's appellate attorney, in which he tracked down the jurors who had convicted him and interviewed them, presenting them with the new evidence that had been denied them during the original trial. He wasn't able to contact all of them. Several of them, however, were willing to talk to him. Owen Tanner was one such juror. It would have been nice to have had this additional evidence at the time of the trial when we had to decide on Mr. Whiteley's guilt or innocence, he told Mel Daniel. I know it would have made a big difference. I too felt that Mr. Whiteley was poorly represented by Mr. Thompson, his public defender. I never dreamed that he would receive such a harsh sentence. I've said before that I agree with Judge Alex Kaczynski of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals that part of the instructions to the jury should be information regarding the potential sentence that would be inflicted upon a citizen if they find him guilty. At present, I don't think there's a jurisdiction in the country that allows a jury to know this. As a matter of fact, that's considered grounds for a mistrial. I think it would have made a difference in our decision if we had known what the sentence would be and could have heard all the evidence. With what evidence that was given to us, I was not totally convinced of his guilt. Then why, the screaming chartreuse hell, did you vote to convict? If you have any reasonable doubt, and reasonable doubt means that if you have so much as a tremor of misgivings about the case being made by the prosecutor, you have a moral duty to acquit. I feel bad that they did not give him another trial. I think he was entitled to a fair and impartial trial with the jury hearing all the evidence. Mr. Tanner's last words in the interview were, "Is there anything I can do to help this man get a fair trial?" Elaine Osuna, "I really didn't think he was guilty." Once again, why didn't this come up in the jury deliberations? Why did you vote to convict? "But he looked so mean," she continued. "All during the trial, he would stare at the jury members. We were all intimidated by him. I felt that I was coerced by the other jury members in finding Mr. Whiteley guilty. They said it was Friday, and they were all tired, and they wanted to get it over with and go home. They didn't want to continue the deliberation over the weekend." This is something that happens all the damn time, and prosecutors know this. If they give the jury a case on a Friday morning, most likely they'll vote to convict because they don't want this to taint their weekend. And why should they, really? They should vote to acquit if such a scenario presents itself. "I'm sorry I went along with them," explained Ms. Osuna. "After hearing the new evidence, I am sure that he would have been found not guilty. I felt that Mr. Whiteley was very poorly represented by his attorney, Stephen H. Thompson." Gwen Miller, "I felt with the evidence that we were given that we had no other choice. Perhaps if all the evidence was made available, then we would have been more able to make a different decision. It didn't help his cause any by looking so mean and staring at the jury. Once again, I don't think he was guilty, but he looked mean. He made me feel uneasy. Therefore, I'll vote to convict. I felt that we were all intimidated by him. I didn't feel that his attorney did a very good job for him. He certainly never spoke to him and his conduct in the courtroom. I thought maybe he might get a year or two, But I had no idea that the judge would give him 2 12-year terms. It's actually, once again, a life sentence. I think it may have made a difference to the jury. Joel Hubble, I feel that we did the best job we could with what little evidence we were given. If the evidence is insufficient, you vote to acquit. It may have made a difference had we been presented with the new evidence. I agree that Mike was his worst enemy, the way he looked so mean and stared at the jury. There is no question he did intimidate the jury. Crystal Johnson, yes, I feel that it would have made a difference had the jury been able to hear all the evidence. I felt that Mr. Thompson did a poor job representing the defendant, Mr. Whiteley. Once again, she complains about his demeanor. When Mike's first wife was on the stand, apparently what she said angered him and he broke a pencil in two, continues Crystal Johnson. This seemed to leave an impression on the jury that he was a mean person. Being mean is not a crime. Being mean is not evidence of a crime. People who have even a rudimentary capacity for critical thought would understand this. This, perhaps, is a really good illustration of the seen versus the unseen. In this case, they saw something that led them to suspect that Michael Whiteley was mean because he broke a pencil. What they didn't see, of course, is the vast apparatus of coercion deployed in the name of this murderous abstraction called the state, the purpose of which is to break human beings. And they didn't understand that their role, their purpose, their moral duty as jurors was to impede the operation of that damnable machinery. I'll be back in just a minute.
High school in Dietrich, Idaho is being sued for $10 million for allegedly allowing a mentally disabled football player to be abused and bullied for months. 3 of his teammates have been charged with sexual assault. The lawsuit says one of the accused attackers reached out as though asking for a hug after practice last October, but instead restrained him and allowed him to be raped with a coat hanger. John Howard and Tanner Ward have been charged as adults, and based on Idaho law, they could spend life in prison.
As I have immersed myself in the bizarre case of Michael Whiteley's unjust conviction and his protracted incarceration, one question has tormented me. Why did he agree to get involved in Sylvia Canito's abortion, an act that, morally at least, would make him the equivalent of an accessory to murder? That's not how the state views that offense. But in moral terms, that's how I would view that offense. What he explained to me, and he provided me with ample documentation to make this claim credible, is that he had made the mistaken assumption that if he helped Sylvia Canito abort this child who was conceived in an act that could be described as rape perpetrated by an Idaho Falls police officer, according to Sylvia Canito herself, that she and her mother would leave him alone. At some point when I write about this case, I'll discuss the months of harassment that Michael Whiteley and his family experienced, including the incident in which she pulled a knife on his son that led to the forcible sex act in which that child was conceived. I cannot justify or mitigate what Michael Whiteley did in procuring the death of that child. That's not why he is in prison, however. Nor is he in prison to make restitution for a crime that he didn't commit, which would be abduction and kidnapping. He's not there in order to protect his putative victim who now resides in Bolivia, nor is he there to protect society at large. He is being punished for the unforgivable offense of asserting his innocence rather than validating the state's accusations against him and submitting to its divine judgment. Now, had he done so, remember, he would have served probably 4 months in jail rather than being threatened with the death penalty and then being sentenced to life in prison. The state's calculations of leniency are always most generous when dealing with somebody who has served its apparatus of punishment and incarceration. If you're a former police officer or a prosecutor or a judge who commits an actual offense against persons and property, you can expect leniency. You can also expect leniency if you simply submit with docility to the judgment of the state rather than daring to assert your innocence and challenging its supposed omniscience. Ironically enough, just within the last couple of days, there is another case out of southeastern Idaho that illustrates this point perfectly. A Dietrich High School football player, originally charged with sexually assaulting a black mentally disabled teammate after an October 2015 football practice, pleaded guilty to a lesser felony Friday, and prosecutors now say it wasn't a sex crime or racially motivated. John R.K. Howard, 19, of Keller, Texas, pleaded guilty in a Twin Falls courtroom to a felony count of injury to a child. He will be sentenced to 2 to 3 years of probation, which he'll likely be able to complete in Texas, and prosecutors will recommend he be ordered to serve 300 hours of community service. But Howard will avoid prison or jail time and could ultimately have his conviction dismissed if he successfully completes probation without violations or committing new crimes. And by submitting an Alford plea, he maintains his innocence while acknowledging prosecutors would be able to win a conviction at trial. District Judge Randy Stoker agreed to bind himself to the plea bargain, which includes a withheld judgment, meaning at sentencing, Stoker will order Howard to be placed on probation, but will not order an underlying prison sentence. A judge will order a prison term only if Howard violates his probation. The maximum penalty a judge could order, should Howard violate his probation, is 10 years in prison and a fine of up to $50,000. He had faced up to life in prison on the previous felony charge of forcible sexual penetration by a foreign object. Deputy Attorney General Casey Hemmer gave a detailed explanation Friday of the evidence prosecutors would have used to convince a jury Howard was guilty, and in a plea advisory form, Howard wrote, "There was sufficient evidence for a jury to convict me." But Hemmer also told Stoker that while Howard's behavior was egregious and caused the victim a lot of suffering, it was not a sex crime, and that's why the Attorney General's office amended the charge to the lesser felony. Court reports said a clothes hanger had been kicked into the victim's rectum. There was no physical evidence that Michael Whiteley had ever committed any crime against Sylvia Canito. "We don't believe it's appropriate for Mr. Howard to suffer the consequences of a sex offender," Hemmer said, "but he still needs to be held accountable." Howard's attorney, Brad Calbo, agreed with Hemmer's recounting of the state's evidence, but said it needs to be crystal clear that this victim was not at any time pinned down, raped, or pinned down and subjected to any sort of forcible penetration. Stoker also asked Hemmer whether prosecutors planned to argue the attack was racially motivated. "Your Honor, based on what we've had, no," Hemmer responded. "I will say that there are things that we found going around that school and that locker room involving a lot of the parties here that had racial undertones. But it's not our belief that this was a racially motivated crime. This was more of a vulnerable victim-motivated crime, as if that would be a more trivial offense. I think it probably would have happened to anybody that was in the same kind of circumstances and mental state as the victim here." That's not what they would have argued had this case gone to trial. Had this case gone to trial, they would have characterized this as a sexual attack. They would have characterized it as racially motivated. They most likely would have sought a hate crimes enhancement, which of course would be making the rubble bounce, as it were, because he would already be facing a life sentence. Despite the court proceedings, a $10 million civil lawsuit filed by the victim is still making its way through U.S. District Court. It claims the locker room attack was the culmination of months of severe and pervasive harassment, racial discrimination, mental and physical assault, and battery. It claims the district school administrators and football coaches were aware of, or should have been aware of, the abuse. The civil suit does not name Howard as a defendant, but it did single him out as a large and aggressive male who had been sent to live with his relatives in Idaho due to his inability to keep out of trouble in Texas. The civil suit claims Howard brought with him from Texas a culture of racial hatred toward the victim, and that the bullying was ignored by administrators and coaches, at least in part due to his athletic ability and community connections. The civil suit accuses Howard of humping and taunting the victim during football practices, forcing him to learn a Ku Klux Klan song while displaying a Confederate flag, knocking him unconscious during football camp as coaches and players cheered in a circle, and calling him racially charged names like Kool-Aid, Chicken Eater, Watermelon, and Nigger. Those claims brought in the civil suit were not addressed in the criminal case, which was solely centered on the locker room attack. But as part of the plea agreement in the criminal case, Howard agreed to complete any classes recommended by his probation officer, including a race-based sensitivity class and anti-bullying class, if they are available. During his explanation of the evidence, the Deputy Attorney General confirmed, without mentioning his name specifically, that 17-year-old Tanner Ward has pleaded guilty in a juvenile case. Ward was originally charged as an adult with forcible penetration by use of a foreign object, but as part of plea negotiations, the charge was amended and moved to juvenile court. There was stuff going on in the locker room. There really wasn't any supervision in there at the time, Hemmer said of the hangar attack. The other party in this case that has pled guilty in juvenile court took a coat hanger and either inserted or swung or in some way caused it to become lodged in the victim's buttocks. It's the state's contention that at some point Mr. Howard purposely kicked that hanger. Hemmer said Howard and his defense team maintain that it was accidental, that he was just kicking at the victim. This reminds me of one of the arguments you hear consistently when an innocent civilian dies at the hands of a police attack. Often police union attorneys will seek out the expert testimony of people who will say in so many words that the victim wasn't killed by the police officer, he just happened to choose that moment to die. That was what was said in the case of Kelly Thomas, who was beaten to death by a thug scrum of 8 Orange County police officers while he was crying out for his father. The expert witness called by the police said that he just happened to choose this minute to die of physical consequences of methamphetamine use several years earlier. You're getting a variant of that argument made on behalf of this depraved sociopath who won clemency from the state because he's not defending himself in court. But in any case, Mr. Howard made contact with that hanger, Hemmer told Stoker. It pushed in far enough into the victim that it penetrated the rectum. How was that not a sexual assault, as the term sex is currently defined in any case? The attack caused the victim to bleed but did not cause permanent damage, Hemmer said. That damage, of course, would be magnified and dwelt upon at length if this case went to trial. The victim has also undergone a lot of mental stress, proving two elements of the charge, that Howard inflicted unjustifiable physical pain or mental suffering under circumstances likely to produce great bodily harm. Stoker imposed a gag order in the case, warning Howard and lawyers from both sides not to speak to the media at least until the sentence is imposed. We know what the result is going to be, Stoker said in reference to the binding plea agreement. There is nothing served by trying this case in the press. Howard waived his appeal rights as part of the plea agreement, but he could also have his conviction dismissed in the future. Upon successful completion of probation, including no proven or admitted probation violations or new crimes, the state will stipulate that the defendant's conviction be reduced to a misdemeanor, the plea agreement said. Defendant will be free to argue that the guilty plea be set aside and the conviction be dismissed. And that is because this individual, who actually committed an act of sexual violence upon a helpless young man, did not defy the state, but submitted to it. Michael Whiteley has been sent to prison, most likely for the rest of his life, in spite of the fact that there is no evidence he ever harmed Sylvia Canito in any way, as an act of exemplary punishment for somebody who had the temerity to maintain his innocence. Thank you for joining me this week on Freedom Zealot Radio. Please join me online at freedominourtime.blogspot.com and at libertarianinstitute.org. I will return in a week, and until then, as always, dum spirito pugno, while I breathe, I fight. Good night, God bless, and may we send the state back to the hell that spawned it.
What do you want to do now, Captain?
The same thing we always do. Fight them until we can't.